we pray here tonight as we study the Word that you'd be present here with us and just giving us that guidance that we desperately need here as we study the Bible. Amen. Revelation chapter 6, the seven seals. This is where it starts to get weird. You guys ready to get weird with me? Revelation chapter 6, verse 1. Then I saw when the Lamb broke one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying as with the voice of thunder, "Come." Well, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. New Testament scholar George Laddie says this, that these are not a part of the great tribulation itself, but are preparatory and preliminary to the great tribulation. So the seven seals are those which are leading up to the tribulation. These could actually be occurring in our own day. Okay, there's nothing in the text which makes us think specifically that these are in the tribulation. These could be right now. Okay, I looked, and behold, a white horse who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Three different perspectives on who this first rider is. Some people think that it's Jesus. They give a few different reasons. First of which, in context, Revelation 6, verse 1, Jesus is mentioned. The Lamb is right there. You get to the very next verse, there's this white rider. Jesus must be the same person. This same individual could be Jesus in Revelation 19, verse 11. We see Jesus there. He's riding on a horse. Guess which color it is? It's white. Same exact color. Could be the same person, same individual. There's also this term, okay, he went out conquering and to conquer. This term here is nikao. Nikao, this is used throughout the book of Revelation to describe the overcoming of believers, as we see throughout the churches. Revelation chapters 2 and 3, it's this repeated overcoming which believers do, not necessarily to conquer. So, this isn't a pejorative word. This could actually be a word used of Jesus. That's not my perspective, that this is Jesus. Let's look at this verse a little bit closer. It says that the individual, he's on a white horse. Now, some people would say that must be the white horse mentioned in Revelation chapter 19, which Jesus is riding. Of course, John Walvoord mentions that in biblical times it was customary for a conqueror to ride in triumph on a white horse. This was just the sign of the times. This is what conquerors rode. It also says here, he who sat on it had a bow. Jesus doesn't have a bow. He's got a sword. Remember we talked about that. There's that image that there's a sword coming out of his mouth. He's going to conquer. Definitely different from Jesus. It also says a crown was given to him. Now, why would a crown be needed to be given to Jesus? Doesn't he rightfully rule? Doesn't the crown belong to him? This picture, it almost pictures Jesus as though an angel is needed to give authority over to Christ. Also, people who hold to this view, who are critical that this is Jesus, when it says conquering and to conquer, are we to believe that this is actually supposed to be the peaceful spread of the gospel message throughout the nations? Kind of difficult to believe. Let's look at Revelation 13:7. Nice cross-reference here. It was also given to him, same language as in this passage, to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Okay? The exact same phrase. To overcome them. That's this individual here, Revelation chapter 13. It isn't Jesus, I'll tell you that. You know who it is? Anti-Jesus. Anti-Christ. That's the picture of the person listed here. In the context, the other three of the four riders after this portion that we're reading here, they're evil. They're not benevolent. They're not loving like Christ. So the context would portend toward the conclusion that this writer isn't peaceful either. Also, we see in verse 1, we already read that verse, the angel tells the rider on the horse to come. So again, we get this picture that we have an angel bossing Jesus around, which doesn't seem to fit with the Jesus of the Bible. Hebrews chapter 1, he's greater than angels. He doesn't need an angel to tell him what to do. Okay? Now, let's think about a third possibility. So it could be Jesus. It could be the Antichrist, or it could be Christian believers. So I know what you're thinking. You're probably thinking, oh, great. So we've narrowed it down to either Christ, the Antichrist, or us. Okay? Well, let's give this perspective, too. I became favorable to this perspective in the last week or so. But it's kind of interesting. See what you think. Okay, number one, Nikao, to overcome, used consistently throughout the book of Revelation. It's used a total of 17 times. Two uses here, Nikao and Nikao. But then 15 times outside of this passage. In 13 of the 15 usages throughout the book of Revelation, it's used of believers or of Christ. So this would actually fit closest with believers. God knows why these particular interpreters of the New American Standard translated this as conquering and to conquer. Could be a reader's bias there. Well, number two, we see throughout the book of Revelation, in particular, Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, that believers are the ones who are given crowns, stephanos. These are the rewards which are given to believers. This individual is given a crown too. Jesus himself in Matthew chapter 24, verse 14, he also predicts that his message of love and forgiveness is going to reach the world before all of these events happen. If you read Matthew 24, this would fit in very nicely. I'm not sure. I'm not the type of personality where I like to have a lot of gray issues. Bothers me. I'd rather come down definitively on one perspective. I think I'm a little bit closer to it either. I think it's either the Antichrist if we take conquering in a negative sense. If conquering is supposed to be overcoming, if it was translated in that sense, this could be the spread of the gospel. Definitely lines up with history. Look at this chart here. This is from 1910, a Pew Research Forum. It says that most believers on earth, they were Anglo-American, okay, probably about 95%. 2010, not the majority of which are non-Anglo-American, but close. We're about to be eclipsed by the Asian and African world. Christianity is not a white person's religion. This is about to be, we're going to be passed up by these other cultures around the world. Just look at Africa. Okay, back in 1800, there's 4 million Christians in Africa. 100 years later, double. 100 years after that, you go from 8 million believers to 357 million believers. At this point today, almost half of a billion believers in Africa. This has all happened in the last 100 years. Super fast. Just as Jesus predicted, it'd be so difficult to believe if you were standing there with Christ, this penniless preacher, this itinerant rabbi, if you're standing there with him and he says, my message of love and forgiveness, it's going to reach the end of the earth. Every tribe, tongue, nation is going to hear about me and my love for them. A couple days later, Jesus was strung up on a cross and killed. 2,000 years later, we're seeing what he's talking about right here. Well, Revelation 6:3, when he broke the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, come. And another, a red horse, went out. And to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, and the men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to him. So this concept of it being granted to this individual, this would be the concept of God's passive wrath. This is in contrast to his active wrath. Active wrath is where God puts his hands on a situation. He smokes somebody. Fire comes down from heaven. Active wrath, very active. This is a different type of God's wrath. This is what's called passive wrath. This is where God takes his hands off. We definitely see this in the lives of believers today. People who don't want to follow Christ, you know what God says to them? Go ahead. You don't want to follow me? I'm not going to twist your arm. This is considered a form of God's wrath for people because it's so desperate. It's so despairing to live a life apart from Christ that it's considered wrathful to not have Christ in your life, for God to do this. This is, in fact, the picture that we get here in Revelation chapter 6. Most of these judgments which are given are not from God putting his hands on individuals or people. By contrast, these are from God taking his hands off of people. He's letting humanity go their course. Paul talks about this. Now, when I'm citing passages here, I'm writing these out here so you can look these up. These are in context. As you look at the chapter, you're going to see, as the narrative or the epistle, the letter goes through, the context is the end of human history. For every single one, these are not taken out of context. Look at this one. This is about the day of the Lord, the end of history. 2 Thessalonians 2:7. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work, writes Paul. Only he who now restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way. Who is the restrainer? We're not sure. All we know is that someone, something is holding back evil on some level. But at some point, this is going to be pulled back. In humanity, it's going to get dirty. It's going to get rugged. This is still ahead of us. Yes, we've seen bloody wars, disgusting, aberrant, violent things in the 20th century. It's going to get worse. Apparently, Christ himself has been holding back on humanity what they want to do. Well, in verse 5, we read, when he broke the third seal, I heard the living creature saying, come, I looked, and behold, a black horse. And he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard something like a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying this, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and don't damage the oil and the wine. What the heck is he talking about here? Okay, this part, not that difficult to interpret. We just have to get back into the cultural milieu at the time, the history, the times. This term denarius, this is the term given for a full day's wage in the ancient world. So if you came and worked for me, you know, today that might be anywhere from, you know, $80 to $200, whatever you make a day. Okay, and an individual will get paid a denarius. So look what he's saying here. A quart of wheat, 4 quarts goes into a gallon, right? A quarter gallon. A quart of wheat for a denarius. A full day's wage. Now, a quart of wheat, that could feed a grown man for a day. This would mean that a grown man, he could feed himself on wheat. He couldn't feed his family. He couldn't pay rent. He wouldn't have anything. This is actually about 12 times more expensive than a quart of wheat cost in John's day. So think about it like this. Let's say you pay $300 rent a month. Just think, if your rent, your landlord contacts you and says it went up 12 times that much. Okay? You go back, you try and get a loaf of bread for $2, 12 times. Inflation going through the roof. Why the shortage? Why would inflation just take off like this? Well, it could be because of war. At the end of human history, the prophets, Jesus, Revelation, they picture a world war. During times of war, very scary. You can't go back to your typical agrarian life where you just produce crops and that sort of thing for other people. It could also be because of natural disasters, times of drought, famine, that sort of thing. As we read through this book, you get this gory picture of what the end of history is going to look like. It could also be, a third option, is that the population is off the hook. As we look at the book of Revelation, we're going to get to this in 2 weeks. Revelation chapter 9 pictures an army of 200 million people at the end of human history. A number so significant, World War II, every army put together, 60 million men total, maybe. This is a picture, 200 million men at the end of history, a number we haven't seen. This must be speaking of astronomical population growth. John himself, when he says it, Revelation 9, he says, it was 200 million people, I heard that number. Now, it wasn't like he was clicking and counting 200 million people. God must have told him 200 million. That's how many there are. Well, we've seen this. I don't know if you've kept up with this at all, but if you look at population rates throughout history, really doesn't change. I mean, if you look from the time of Christ, let's say, it's estimated, I've heard, anywhere from 200 million to 300 million. Not that many. It stays relatively static. You think of infant child mortality, disease. People would live to old ages, but most people would die early. So the mean age, very young. Until you hit about the 19th century, you hit about a billion people. At this point, the population rates are astronomical. Every generation, okay, we go about 100 years to get to 2 billion people. How long does it take to get to 3 billion? Just about 30 years. How long does it take to get to the next billion? 20 years, 10 years, 10 years. We're going up. In our generation, we're seeing something unprecedented. Population growth's going off the hook. Colin Sullivan, this is as recent as it gets, 2013. This is from Scientific American. He says, Earth's human population is expected to coast upward to 9.6 billion by 2050, and 10.9 billion by 2100, up from 7 billion people alive today. You definitely get different perspectives between individuals. This is a pretty conservative estimate. To hit about 9.6 billion in 2050, most of us here will be alive at that point. That's not that far away. We could actually live to see this happen. One of the things that's particularly disturbing, as you read the literature in this area, from different perspectives, most people posit once you get to 9 or 10 billion people, there is going to be a global cataclysm. There is just not going to be enough food, water, fishing, pollution. We can't sustain that many people on planet Earth today. Well, verse 7, when the Lamb broke the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come. I looked, and behold, an ashen horse. Other translations will say green, pale green. I think ashen sounds cooler, so I'll leave it with ashen. And he who sat on it had the name Death, and Hades was following with him. Authority was given to them over to a fourth of the earth. So again, this language of passive judgment. He's handing over the deed, the title deed to the earth. You can get a quarter of the earth. To do what? To kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. This is going to be a state, a status in human history that's going to get deplorable, devastating. To kill with the sword. Now, we need to realize here, these four horsemen, these are symbolic figures of these particular things. Remember we said the first horseman, that could be Jesus, that could be the Antichrist or Antichrists that lead up to the end of history, as 1 John 2 says. It could also be the Christian community leading up. So it wouldn't just be an actual figure. We're not sure. This here, this horseman, the ashen horse, this is symbolic for world war. to kill with the sword. Some people like to ask, well, is this really plausible in our world today, globalization, that we'd actually see a world war? Hey, we just saw two world wars not that long ago. Yes, definitely plausible. This could happen just as quickly. The Bible definitely points toward this conclusion. In Revelation 6:12, this is at the end of our chapter, we read, I looked when he broke the sixth seal, there was a great earthquake and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair. And the whole moon became like blood. Well, of course, this here, this is observational language. He doesn't mean that it literally became like black cloth or a sackcloth. He doesn't mean that the moon was made of cheese, you know, made of blood, that sort of thing. Notice the language of simile here. The sun became black as sackcloth. The moon became like blood. It's not that it actually was blood, but from the observer's point of view, this would be the sun was blacked out, the moon. It could be that there's debris up in the air, refracting the light, giving it a different color. We're not certain. Verse 13, and the stars fell from the sky to the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind. So apparently the earth is just getting plummeted at this point. And what does it mean here? The stars of the sky fell to the earth. I know some critics of the Bible, they'll say, well, see, it just shows ancient people, they thought that stars out in the sky, they thought that those could actually collide into the earth. This is figurative, again, observational language. Picture this scene here, a father with his kid. He turns to his son. Look, son, it's a meteorite. Is that what he would say? No, unless he was a nerd. He would probably say, you know, something like this. Look, a shooting star. Now, what if you were standing next to that father? Excuse me. You're miseducating your son. Stars don't actually fall into the earth. It's not a shooting star. That's a meteorite. That's a piece of, and that's not a piece of a star. Okay, you'd be like, dude, you know, get away from me, whatever. Verse 14, the sky was split apart like a scroll when it's rolled up, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. So he's seeing an earthquake. He's seeing stuff come from the atmosphere, coming down to the earth. Striking into the earth, the ground is shaking. At this point here, he says that the sky was split open, split in two. Now, again, this is a first century observer. He's looking at these images. He doesn't have a category for them. Just think, if you were born in the first century, what would you think of this building? How would you describe this? How would you describe an automobile? What if somebody showed you a picture of a space satellite? How would you describe it? What language would you use? He's saying here, I'm looking at something and just, it's like the sky is ripped in two. A common theme throughout the Bible. Matthew chapter 24, verse 22. This again, in the Olivet Discourse, this is about the end of human history, the same period which Jesus is describing. Verse 22, he says, unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. Guys, this is in a period of human history where people were using spears and sticks to fight each other. Jesus is picturing just an epic battle in which people, if it gets so bloody, so terrible, all life on earth would go extinct. Utterly ridiculous to a first century reader. To people today, not that ridiculous. Very, very likely. In fact, this fits closer with what we know today than it did in its actual time period. What about the book of Isaiah? Well, we're going way back, 2,700 years. Isaiah chapter 24, verse 6. A curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. This is describing the same picture. If you read through your Bible, you're going to get through the Old Testament, the prophets, it's the same picture, a terrible world war, the coming of Messiah, peace, right here in Isaiah. We're in the midst of world war. Notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say that people were stabbed to death. It doesn't say that people were decapitated. Those types of killing were occurring in Isaiah's own day. This says the people were burned. People en masse burned to death. I'm telling you, at that time, not common to picture that an entire group of people, so much so that it says few men are left. Verse 19, it says the earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently. The earth reels to and fro like a drunkard, and it totters like a shack. For its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall, never to rise again. Now, as people who believe in the Bible, has this happened yet? No, this has not happened. The earth is going to be in such a destitute state that it won't be able to recover ever again. Yes, our earth is in a difficult state as we speak, but nothing like this. This must be something still in the future. What about Zechariah, another prophet? He says in Zechariah 14:12, "Now this will be the plague which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem." Again, the same pattern. This battle at the end of human history, people surrounding the nation of Israel, trying to destroy it. Then you have the Messiah come back, rescue, and then a period of peace. Same exact formation. It says, their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet. Now, an ancient person, an ancient individual would look at something like this. Yes, they were aware of the concept of leprosy. Your skin would rot. Skin diseases, plagues, that sort of thing. That's not what this says. This says here, their flesh will rot while they still are on their feet. Before they've even hit the ground, their flesh is coming off their skeleton. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongue will rot in their mouth. So what are we picturing here? What, we think people are walking around deathly sick with their eyes falling out of their sockets? This could be, if the picture here is an instantaneous, heat wave, it could be a picture before people can even hit the ground, they're just instantaneously incinerated. Well, from an ancient person's perspective, doesn't make much sense. I mean, what would this be? You put them into like a furnace, you hold them up so that before they can fall, their flesh just melts, that sort of thing. Maybe a burning at the stake, something like that. From a 21st century perspective, this is an all too clear picture. Let's get a look here. Video. Biggest nuclear blast on record. It was let off in Russia. They actually didn't know how big of the fallout was going to be. It flattened. Remember, you see that shockwave come toward you? You notice that? And the whole camera shakes. That shockwave reached, the fallout was up to 50 miles away. Entire villages just wiped out. Yes, I would dare to say at this point your flesh would rot off your face if you were standing right there. They must have had that behind, several layers of plexiglass. I wouldn't want to be there when that happened. Well, this entire picture, this is something very close to what we see in Scripture, definitely fits a lot better today than it did back then. A first century reader, this wouldn't have made much sense. Today it does. Well, Revelation 6:15, then the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks and the mountains. Apparently, they just go underground at this time. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Verse 17, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? This is going to be to be honest, I'm not trying to scare anybody, but to be completely forthcoming, this is going to be a very scary period in human history. No, I would not want to be there. It's spoken of in the New Testament, in the Old, hundreds of times. It's spoken of as the period leading up to the great and terrible tribulation. Well, it speaks of world war. That could definitely happen. And we're seeing here the pictures in Scripture that are describing this epoch in human history, very realistic to a modern reader. It also dictates that there's going to be famine at this time. Of course, some people say, well, this is the book of Revelation. How are we supposed to know what it's saying? This is apocalyptic. What about Jesus Christ? Do you trust him? He spoke about this exact same period in the exact same terms. Luke chapter 21, verse 11, he says, there will be great earthquakes. That same picture where it feels like the ground beneath your feet is going to fall out. He says in various places, plagues and famines. There's going to be a period in human history where it just gets rugged. Here's Meadows and Randers. This is their 30-year update on their book, Limits to Growth. This was basically a futuristic picture of where human history was headed. This is 30 years later. Three decades went by. They get to look back on their research and their projections. They write this, the increase in food production has been attained by policies that damage soils, waters, forests, and ecosystems, a cost that will make future production increases more difficult. They picture, as we keep going on, that population graph we talked about, yes, there are going to be consequences as a result of that. We can't just keep growing. They're picturing there's going to be serious food shortages. Richard Heinberg, 2011, in his book, The End of Growth, he says demand for food is slowly outstripping the supply. Food supply is increasingly being strained by rising human populations, falling freshwater supplies, the rise of biofuels industries, expanding markets within industrializing nations. The result will almost inevitably be a worldwide food crisis sometime in the next two or three decades. He's predicting here, no, this isn't going to be in our grandchildren's time. He said this could be in our lifetime. We could see this. Sir John Beddington, he's a Brit. This is from the UK Science Symposium. By 2030, that's only 17 years, we're going to need 50% more food, 40% more available fresh water, and something on the order of 50% more low-carbon energy. We need a radical redesign of global food systems. Everybody sees this. It's amazing. You talk to Christians. They read the book of Revelation, Jesus' terms, there's words, rather, the Old Testament prophets, allegorical, not literal, never going to happen. Then you speak with your atheistic, secular specialist in the area, and they're like, yeah, we picture the exact same conditions which the Bible depicts. Kind of freaky. It also mentions pestilence. Of course, pestilence is plagues, disease, that sort of thing. Again, Jesus says the same thing. Luke 21, 11. Earthquakes and plagues. Of course, ancient people, they were scared of plagues like this, diseases. Modern people, once we hit the modern era, we started to get the sense as a human race that we were safe from disease, we were protected from it, we have developed antibiotics, vaccinations. People in the early 20th century started to get the sense we're going to get past this. reading something like this, that there are going to be plagues so significant that they should be listed on par with world war and with world famine? Seem kind of strange. Not so much today. With the overprescription of antibiotics, one of the things we've been seeing in the medical field worldwide, but particularly in the third world, antibiotics, you don't need them to be prescribed at all. You just go to the local pharmacist and you can buy them for cheap. They're being overprescribed to the point where we're creating super viruses. Antibiotics will kill a bunch of things in your system, but that which remains are kind of these different viruses which we can't keep up with. Here's Fred Gutterall. He's the executive editor of Scientific American. This is a secular scientist, 2012. He says in 1918, the H1N1 virus burned through the world in less than 2 years, despite the lack of air travel, leaving 50 million to 100 million people dead in its wake. Nobody knows precisely how many died. Information about influenza deaths was hard to come by back then, and it is in many ways today. At the time, the world held 1.6 billion people. By simple extrapolation to the current population of more than 7 billion, a similar disaster today would leave 180 million to 375 million dead. He also points out, he's quoting here from Dr. Robert Webster of St. Jude's Children's Hospital, this isn't him, talking about the H1N1 pandemic virus. This was back in 2009. You may have heard about that. The bird flu. Everyone got real panicked. Then it turns out it wasn't that big of a deal. It just gave you the sniffles. A couple people died. Not a big of a deal. Okay? Sorry if you're related to some of them who died. Don't mean to be insensitive, but I never met them, so I don't care. Anyways, this time we got damn lucky. He says the virus was only mildly pathogenic. If H1N1 had truly killed as effectively as the 1918 flu, it would have been a total disaster. People said at this time, well, it's just the pharmaceutical companies are in with the CDC, Center for Disease Control. They basically got people to get a big scare so people get their vaccination. Pharmaceutical companies make a bunch of money. But it was just a big hoax, not that big of a deal. As it turns out, in the health community, it was a big deal. This virus appeared. They didn't know where it came from. They didn't know its lethality. They didn't know how bad it was. As it turns out, we lucked out. It wasn't. It was pretty innocuous for most people. But they say if it had been, if the jackpot had come up as it did back in the early 20th century, we would have been in big trouble. You wouldn't get the gasoline for your car. You wouldn't get the electricity for your power. You wouldn't get the medicines that you need. Society as we know it would fall apart. There wouldn't be a hell of a lot scientists could do for you in the first wave. Joshua Lederberg, this is a Nobel Prize winner, molecular biologist. He says a million passengers a day cross national boundaries by air. You ever think about that? How many people leaving here, going there? Everybody's flying everywhere. Not to mention the movement of armies, refugees, and road transport as well documented vehicles for the rapid spread of disease. From this perspective, we have never been more vulnerable. At least in 1918, when it took out, 50 million people, or the Black Plague, even earlier, at least back then, took out even more people. At least it was isolated to some degree. If you had gotten the virus, you probably weren't hopping on an airplane to go to Europe on vacation that week. At least it was contained to some degree. Today, what, you think that they can monitor diseases passing like that? They certainly try. Something like this happened, you'd either. You'd have to just stop air travel, lock it down, or you just have to let it spread. Let it have its way. Martin Rees, he's the prestigious agnostic, cosmologist, scientist over in Great Britain. He chaired at Cambridge since 2004. He says in his book, The Final Hour, I think the odds are no better than 50-50 that our present civilization on Earth will survive to the end of the present century. If you read through his book, he gives a bunch of different perspectives about the way it could end. It's not just that it's possible. He gives evidence that it's probable. This is heading in that direction. If it's not that, it's this. If it's not this, it's that. Well, when the Lamb broke the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar of souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" This is apparently what these believers are speaking, chanting in heaven. I know from my perspective, it's a little bit different. You know, from your perspective, you might be thinking, he could wait. Okay, I don't want to see this all hell breaking loose. At least until after I die, then it can probably happen. But at this point, you're not really that interested. From their perspective here, they're like, God, we know that you're just. We know that you're good. Why would you let the world go on like this? We read in Psalm 16, verse 15, "Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his godly ones." Good passage, usually brought up at funerals. You think about this. God weeps over people like this who are getting martyred, you know, wasted away. And so it kind of gives us this conflicting perspective here. Earth's perspective, our view, man, we could wait to see this happen. We're not in any rush to see the end of human history reach its climax. From heaven's perspective, they're like, let's just get it over with. Why would God refrain week in, week out, year in, year out, while the world is just suffering? People are being killed, hurt. The answer, the reason why God waits, Peter writes about this, 2 Peter 3:9. The Lord is not slow about his promise. The context here, when is Christ coming back to judge the earth? He's not slow to come back, as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. Boy, if you're sitting here with us tonight and you have been putting off that decision to receive the gift of Christ, the gift of grace in your heart, which you may have heard about. The Bible certainly speaks about it all the time. It's that gift of forgiveness. If you've been putting off that decision, man, this passage is saying God is holding back on coming to the earth so that more people like you could come into a relationship with him. That's why he's waiting. Pretty significant reason. I mean, I wouldn't want to be around during this period. Apparently, God is trying to reach the maximum number of people in a relationship with himself. Well, verse 11, there was given to each of them a white robe, and they were told that they should rest for a little while longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed, even as they had been, would be completed also. Apparently, you see this through Scripture, this language that the sufferings of believers is not yet complete. We actually have a mission here. It's not that God is a sadist. It's that he's saying we've got to reach people with this message. We want to see the maximum number of people reach with this message of love and forgiveness before everything hits the fan. As he says, it hasn't happened yet. Well, let's think about some conclusions here. Is this a believable scenario? Now, typically, when you think about the book of Revelation, you get it from the perspective of the street preacher. You know, he's usually screaming so loud, his voice is going hoarse. The end is nigh, you know. And they usually have, like, the National Enquirer or Star magazine as their evidence, you know. That's not the picture we're getting here. Okay, the picture that we're seeing, these different criteria that need to be met before the end of human history, they either already have been met or we're really close. We're right there. This picture, which would have seemed implausible even 100 years ago, a century ago, today, crystal clear. This is more evidence of the fact. Remember, we talked about the difference between preterism and futurism. A preterist thinks that the book of Revelation should be interpreted in the first century. A futurist thinks it should be interpreted in the last century. This would be further evidence of that fact. The closer and closer we get to the end of history, the clearer and clearer these prophecies become. That's what we're seeing here. This picture, completely plausible. The question is, are people at this time going to turn to God for forgiveness? Sadly, they're not. As we see throughout the book of Revelation, many people do come to Christ, many don't. Even as they're going under judgment, they're in a world that God has just handed over. You want to rule this world? Go ahead. At that point, people are in control and they're still cursing God. We're going to get to the point in Revelation 14. It says an angel is flying through the mid-heaven preaching an eternal gospel. And people are just like, no thanks. I don't want any. The real question is, not are people going to come to Christ then in the future? The question is, are you going to come to Christ tonight? I'm telling you, this isn't something you want to put off. It's something, as the book of Hebrews says, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. There's something about hearing about the awesome forgiveness of Christ and saying, I'll look at that later. I don't want to come to terms with that right now. It has a hardening effect on your heart. It's kind of like if I, got my wife a Christmas gift this year. I hand her the gift. I'm like, check it out. And she's like, I'll look at that after you open your present. Okay, so I open my presents. Then we go back to the gift. You want to open it now, honey? Huh? No? She's like, no, we'll open it after we see your parents. Okay, no big deal. Get back. You want to open your gift now? She's like, I'll open it tomorrow. I like to open my gifts after Christmas anyways. Okay. Finally, 6 months go by, and that gift is collecting dust up on the mantle. You know, at some point, I would get pretty pissed. You know what I'm saying? At some point, we would probably be going to marriage counseling. Okay, I got my wife this nice gift. I don't know what's the matter with her. I spent a lot of money and thought on it, This is the same thing. When God gives you the gift of his son, and it's just like, boom. That's the best gift I could ever give you. And you say, I'll open it later. Dude, don't do that. I'm telling you. Open it right now. You could do that here with us tonight. We're going to pray. You could just open your heart up to Christ. I'll tell you, you're not going to regret that. It's going to be awesome. Well, there's probably more we could cover there. But if you're a first-time guest here, is hospitality. We like to give out a free drink. We've also got a free book you can read, which talks about some of the other evidences for why we should believe in the Bible beyond what we talked about here tonight. Left us a little bit of time we can discuss. Maybe somebody has a question, a comment, maybe something they want to add on here. Okay, how about over here?
Yeah, so I did a personal study in Revelation not too long ago, and I read in my study Bible that I believe that two of the beasts that come out of the ocean and the land, one was the false prophet, one was the Antichrist. I believe so. That's what it said in the commentary. So I was wondering, what would you say to that, and how could the Antichrist be one of the four horsemen if he's mentioned later?
We haven't gotten to that subject yet. We're still in chapter 6. This is the prelude up until you get to the tribulation. Now, this period of the tribulation, yes, the Antichrist, which the Bible speaks about frequently, he's going to appear at that period, but not yet. So that whole language that you're using, the beast, the false prophet, it never calls him the Antichrist in the book of Revelation. It calls him the beast, but it's the same figure. That's going to come up in weeks to come. You're just going to have to come back and hear about it. Okay, how about down here?
When you were talking about the horseman pestilence, who's obviously not a figure, but like a symbol or allegory, whatever you want to use, excuse me, all I could think of is the 1990 Tokyo sarin gas attacks. And oddly enough, a biology discussion I had in sophomore year of how there's still two vials of smallpox left in the world, one in Atlanta and one in Russia. And, you know, you hear about all these horrible things like anthrax and, you know, cyanide and all that. Do you think that, just because, like, I have an irrational fear of that stuff getting out in the world, do you think that could be a possible pestilence type thing, a man-made plague of anthrax or chemical weapons and stuff like that?
Well, it doesn't state. So I think in these kind of situations, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4:6, we should be careful not to exceed what's written. It just says plagues. It says disease. I don't know what form or forms that's going to come in. I hesitate to kind of jump on the bandwagon. I'm sure you agree, you know, where you see these Christians that jump onto these different things. I'm just not sure. I'd rather be conservative in my claim, so I'm not sure. What I will say, if you read Gutterill's book, I think it's called The Fate of the Species. That's the guy from Scientific American. In that book, he describes that there was the 1983 bird flu. With bird flu, it's swapping DNA with human flu, influenza. It's going back and forth. Very difficult to track and to keep up with antibiotics. Well, he describes there is the 1983 bird flu. It basically goes out into the avian population, gets swapped around, mutates, and then comes back. He says that there was the first outbreak, then a second. He says in the second outbreak, of the thousands and thousands of proteins on that chain for that virus, it came down to one protein. Had it been different, had it been the other direction, that would have been like a super virus, a killer. As it turns out, we lucked out. So I'm not sure. I don't know if God is waiting. It could be that restraining effect that he's basically waiting until the end of human history. So I think we have great reason to trust that the Lord is going to hold back on this kind of stuff to some degree. Okay. All right. Luke.
I think it's real cool seeing some of these things that they predicted thousands of years ago that are just now becoming clear. And one of them, I was thinking about just last week on Facebook. There's this advertisement for this card called the coin, and you like load all of your different credit cards onto this one card, and you can use it for anything.
Yeah.
And immediately I was thinking about the mention of the mark of the beast and how it says that no one can buy or sell without this mark. And man, I think in the past 2 or 3 years, like 3 bastards have gotten my credit card number and like racked hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're talking about and planning. We're already in planning chips all the time. And it just seems like one more little step to have something like this coin implanted, and then it could be encrypted and you'd have to scan it. And these guys wouldn't be stealing the money anymore.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's credit card frauds in the billions. So, I mean, when money's at stake, it seems like there's a lot of motivation. So, I don't know, just another one of those things that, like, it seems like it could line up, whereas, you know, even just 50 years ago, it would be absurd to think that you couldn't buy or sell without this mark.
Well, we're definitely getting there. That's going to be in chapter 13. It makes this claim that nobody can buy or sell without this mark. What's the mark? I don't know. That's where I think Christians go wrong. I appreciate you being conservative with what you're saying. You're like, I'm not sure. It seems like it could be. I'm not either. All I know is that it specifically says you can't use currency without it. And so the picture is very clear. I'm going to have to bite my tongue on that comment because we're going to come back to it in a couple weeks. Get to chapter 13. Okay?
Is this thing on?
Yep.
Hi. I was hoping that you could comment more in regards to the moons like blood. I've done a little bit of reading about that, and it seems that any time that a Jewish feast coincides with these moons that are blood, you know, blotted out like blood, there's been a significant event that's happened in Israel. And I didn't know if you knew anything about that or what your opinion was on that.
I didn't know anything about that. I'm not sure. What I've read on the concept of the moon, it says looking like blood. Again, not that it was blood. It looking like blood. They said back, I think it was the I think it was in the 1800s, there was a big explosion. Was it Krakatoa? Late 19th century. They said that the moon looked like it was blue, bright blue, basically because all this volcanic ash and stuff went up into the air. And this, you know, the light coming from the moon is refracted to look white or look pale. With all that stuff up in the air, it refracted it to the blue end of the spectrum. The same could be true. It's either the blue end or the red end. It could go to the other direction, too. So that's as far as I'd want to take that. I haven't heard of anything about the nation of Israel in particular. So I guess I'll just refrain from overstepping there. Yeah, what do you think?
Hi. So I was kind of thinking about this and how we're sort of just talking about how, you know, all of these different things and technologies are developing in our day where this could be a real possibility. And a while ago, this used to really freak me out, this subject, because it's kind of scary thinking that these terrible atrocities might be seen in our day, you know, and in our generation. I couldn't even imagine what it would have been like to live through something like the Holocaust, you know, and what that could look like happening again. You know, that sounds terrifying, but I think it's just cool to keep in mind when we're talking about these things that when we have that relationship with Christ, we know how it's going to end for us, and we know that it's going to be a good thing and that God's going to provide. So I just think it's good to keep that in mind when we're talking about these things and to know that we can have hope in the middle of these things that are probably going to make us question our faith, honestly. And I just think that's always good to remember.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a terrible time to live. It does speak on the question of security, doesn't it? That people have this, not actual security in this world, more of like an illusion. It's an illusion that we're secure when we're really not. One thing that this book does, it's binary in the way that it approaches us. It gets us to think it's either the world or Christ. And the security doesn't come from the world. So either A or B, not B. Therefore, A. It's like it kind of gets you to start thinking about that. I do want to talk about the subject, are Christians going to be here in this period, the tribulation, this awful period of history? But we're going to have to talk about that next week where we get this picture, this vision. It's up in heaven. And we're going to raise the question, are Christians going to be there? There's three basic positions. The pre-tribulational rescue, the mid-tribulational rescue, and the post-tribulational rescue. I'm a pre-tribulational rescue guy, okay? So I don't think we're going to be there. Which, dude, we see this throughout the Bible. You look back at Sodom and Gomorrah, God gets his people out. The first time the world came to an end with the flood, God got his people out. It could be the same thing here. You'll have to be the judge of that, though. You'll have to come back and check it out. Well, why don't we close down here? I know we got more to talk about, but I want to leave some time for prayer.